The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
In that phase one of a superinflation or hyperinflation, stocks do better than gold just before you get wiped out. Now, are you smart enough to pull the trigger and get out? Because you're talking about massive growth and figuring out, it's almost like, where do you jump off the roller coaster? Where do you jump off? How do you jump off? If you believe that you can, you probably don't understand the structure of that ride.
Now, here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, I always look forward to this every year, Dave. At the end of the year, listeners send in their questions. And every year, they sort of surprise us because some are financial questions, some are philosophical questions, and then some actually sort of border into science questions. Not that we're scientists, but it's interesting to see the variation of the questions every year.
Well, I think one of the things that has defined our 11-year conversation is that we, as individuals are curious about lots of things. And that curiosity comes out in our searching for connections between different fields. And sometimes you gain insight from one particular field of study that would seem to have nothing to do at all with where the question originally started. But there's a way to analyze an understanding that comes from seeing things from a different perspective. It's one of the reasons why when we think about economics, we think that macroeconomists are somewhat hampered in being able to see the world as it is because they're looking at it through a very limited lens. And the questions that they're asking are sometimes in a very small box.
Well, and one of the things that I've found is if I really look at my circle of friends, the people I look forward to getting together with, they're curious people, almost to a person. And I found that our listeners are curious people as well. So why don't we jump right into the questions? And we're going to make this a two-part program. So you'll hear this week some of the questions, and then next week we'll pick up with it.
Excellent. Let's get started.
Our first question. Recently, I've been reading and listening to a lot of information surrounding Deutsche Bank and its restructuring attempts to offload distressed assets. For example, back in July, they sold off a lot of them, and then they recently made another deal with Goldman. But of course, nobody wants to buy just the radioactive trash, so they've sweetened the deal by wrapping it up in a Frankenstein capital release unit, quotations, which contains not only toxic assets, but a lot of good profit-making assets. So Deutsche loses quite a bit of money off of these deals. I've heard a figure of upwards of $2 billion in downwind revenue loss for the July sell-off. So I suppose the basic premise of my question is, which do you think will happen first? Will these toxic assets explode and bring Deutsche Bank to the brink, or will she end up thrusting herself on a bitter spike? Love the show. Thanks in advance, Nick.
Thanks, Nick. I think a couple of things to keep in mind. One, the ECB still is keeping interest rates at an incredibly low level, and we still see negative rates in many of the jurisdictions in Europe. And that's one of the things that keeps things going longer than they would otherwise. There is no penalty for running a poor business or making poor bets in a world of free capital. So, you know, just like we've seen banks in Japan go on and on and on after the Japanese crisis many decades ago, part of that was because they didn't have to pay the piper. And so there is this sense in which we expect to see Deutsche Bank implode. On the other hand, they don't necessarily have to. We've got Fed liquidity in the global markets. We've got ECB liquidity in those markets. And I think very telling about the market sentiment in terms of Deutsche Bank today, if you look at credit default swaps, specifically on Deutsche Bank, their senior secured paper, there's no worry in the market today. It's actually priced today basically where it was in 2007 when there was no concern in the marketplace. So, you know, it's not as if they are just barely hanging on and getting ready to throw in the towel. Looking at what it costs to insure against default on their senior secured paper, it's very inexpensive. There's little to no concern. And it doesn't mean that can't change very quickly, but things can and often do take longer, particularly in a period where again, that the consequences have been taken away because the cost of capital has been lowered as it has been over the last several years.
And it's a strange irony that we just finished a white elephant gift exchange here in the office. And some of the gifts were great. Some of the gifts were something you absolutely would not want to take home. And in a way, that's how these gifts are packaged from Deutsche Bank and what we saw 10 years ago. You really don't know what's inside the package always. So even though there's not concern today, there could be concern tomorrow. Right, Dave?
Yeah, and that's something that we do. We watch on a weekly basis, whether it's JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank looking at the prices of credit default swaps. And honestly, today, there's virtually no concern. It's ironic. As we've talked about in the commentary before, looking at the VIX and other indicators of stress, coming into 2020, there is zero, according to the market, there is zero reason for concern. Now, how wise the market is, I guess we'll find out in 2020.
Well, and if we're looking back 10 years, we'll go ahead and go to Devin's question, because he says, why is too big to fail not considered antitrust? And, you know, 10 years ago, if you were too big to fail, you actually got through the crisis. If you weren't, you actually didn't.
And so I think it's a fair question. And it points to the fact that really we do have antitrust issues if you're talking about the financial markets today. And, you know, this is kind of where, and you have an odd mixture of not only privatized gains and socialized risks, because that's what we've ended up with through the period of crisis, global financial crisis, over 10 years ago, where the too big to fail became even bigger. But there's also something that I think is worth commenting on, and it's one of the weaknesses within free market capitalism. And this is, you know, maybe considered a heretic here, but particularly when you look at Austrian economics, there is this sense in which just let business be business. And yet there's a tendency towards monopoly. There is a tendency towards control. And I think ultimately that's what you've had is the confluence after the crisis of panic marriages and shotgun weddings and things where, yes, you ended up with too big to fail is now even bigger. Yes, that's antitrust issues. But we got to those large too big to fail type entities in part because of collusion and control natural to a process of someone who wants to grow a business and grow a business and grow a business and grow a business and grow a business. And again, I'm not generally critical of the Austrian school, but there is a weakness there, which is you can't really resolve the problem of monopoly.
And isn't it strange, Dave, that you start with Austrian economics and it turns into monopoly, but then when it gets to be too big to fail, then it actually hands things over to the central planners. And so it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where you lose free market economics because of monopoly.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that changes is you go from being innovative, growth-oriented, and expanding a particular franchise to then all of a sudden defending turf. And that's when it gets political. That's when you move into the world of antitrust where you're actually trying to, as a monopoly, trying to block anyone coming in. You're guarding your space. Hmm. And so you can see a philosophical conversion from, I'm a free market capitalist, I love to take risk, and here's the benefits of it over the long term, to, I'm happy to work with the state to defend my turf. And at that transition, I don't know exactly where the transition point is.
Let's call it Tesla.
Okay.
All right. Let's do. Okay. So our next question is from Finland, from Antti. And Antti says, what is your view on the emerging double-digit growth new market logic that has recently formed in the largest market in the world? The market is, of course, called big data. And the new market logic is called surveillance capitalism and has been academically documented by Professor Shoshana Zuboff. We should have her as a guest.
Well, I think that's a large part of the answer. The question is that conversation should include the author of that book, Surveillance Capitalism. I have seen it. I've read good reviews of it, but I have yet to get through it. So, yeah, what Professor Zuboff is getting at and what the question suggests in terms of big data and there being a new market logic, I think it's very important. A couple of general comments. One is that we have to be aware that privacy has been dead now for 1.5 to 2 decades. You know, so that I think is just a flat reality. There was an article, Kevin, that you and I talked about a number of years ago, coming from Foreign Affairs magazine, and the title of it dealt with big data, and the content was all about correlation.
Yeah, correlation versus consequence. If you think of the two C's, you know, we as humans, part of wisdom is to learn about the consequences of certain things and realize that not everything causes everything else, whereas big data correlates things. And you and I were talking about, let's say that you bought a particular stock. Let's say that you went out and bought Apple stock 3 days in a row, and those mornings you had an espresso. Well, if a computer was matching both of those things together, the next time you had an espresso, it might go out and buy Apple. That's not necessarily a consequence. It's a correlation. And that's the problem. When the world starts thinking in correlation, human wisdom no longer works.
Yeah, and I think that's a very excellent point. There's a kind of knowledge and a kind of analysis which is non-numeric. And, you know, more and more what we're seeing is just the math.
Hmm.
And just the math is not entirely human. I mean, it's not that math is devoid of humanity. It certainly is a part of who we are, the way our minds are structured, but it's not the only aspect of how we arrive at conclusions. And I think part of this is we move towards a greater and greater confidence in the word progress. And progress has been defined over the last several, not just decades, but maybe even centuries, by science, the role of science, and the role of mathematics. And there's no doubt that progress can be detailed. It can be highlighted. It can be documented. And science and math have had something to do with it. But we begin to fall in love with it to the exclusion of other things, which are equally important.
Well, so, we stop recognizing the decisions. So the market starts to become unrecognizable when it starts making big data decisions.
And I think the presumption of the people who control the data is, okay, we now own the product. The product is us. That is, they own us because they own our history. And to the degree that they own our history, they believe, okay, now we can drive consumption, we can drive distribution, we can drive marketing, and everything is done in such a way that it's a different kind of captured audience.
Pulverini? Who?
Becker Pulverini?
Yeah. Becker was talking about that, how we become the product and they basically say, it's worth it to you. We're going to give it to you for free for now so that we can later tell you how to buy and what to buy.
But let's do this. I think to expand that conversation, we come back to a conversation and invite Shoshana onto the program. Perhaps she'll join us, perhaps she won't, but Surveillance Capitalism is a book that's actually on my reading list. And so for 2020, that'll make its way into our conversation one way or the other.
This next question is from Charles. He says, I'm a Spanish 29-year-old. And just for background, I've been listening to your weekly commentary for about a year now. I got to you through Doug Noland, who I found out through Real Vision TV. Thanks for all the work you do. It's highly instructive. My question is, why do specialists of the financial and economics world keep speaking about mistakes carried out by central bankers as if they were not intended decisions? Before I go on, Dave, would you answer that part of the question?
Sure. Yeah, I think a part of it is these are not mistakes according to the textbooks that have been read, according to the philosophies that are subscribed to, or what we could call a textbook bias. And so they're doing their best work and they're executing on it. And it's not a mistake. This is good work. When you talk about the financial planners, the central bankers, they're doing very good work in their view. So where's the critique? It's undeserved because not only do we have the work done, but particularly after the global financial crisis, they would assess their work as being very effective. And the decisions made, they ring true in terms of the results, having been positive. And so evidence or exhibit A is, did we go into the financial apocalypse? No. Therefore, what we did is the answer. And we knew that because the textbooks told us it would. Now, I guess what we have yet to see, and I think we will see, is that the extend and pretend policies they put in place actually didn't change anything structurally. So, you know, will we see consequences, longer term consequences to the decisions that have been made? Yes, I think we will. And, you know, what is the time frame for that? Frankly, it's anyone's guess. But, you know, and this is coming back to that sort of Austrian school. A part of that is an influence in my mind that there are consequences. And a part of those consequences, that the time frames can't be measured because it's not just math. There's psychology involved. There's sociology involved. There's human actors who at some point are fed up and say, it worked. Now it's not working anymore.
Well, and doesn't it boil down to either central controlling or individualized control. And we all lean somewhere in the middle or to one side of those areas. And, you know, we had a guest on, Pippa Malmgren, and she characterized it as saltwater thinkers and freshwater thinkers. The saltwater thinkers were more centralized control. The freshwater were more individualized control. And that's always a battle. But Dave, the central bankers that we've had on the show, without exception, have been surprising. So when people think, well, these are evil, ill-intended people that because they're controlling the world, what you find is they're actually, most of them, the ones we've talked to, actually have good intentions. They're just in a system maybe that a lot of us might not agree with the power that they have.
Right. Now, we've not talked to Volcker, Kant anymore. Greenspan, we could, don't know that he would come on the program, but both of them changed pragmatically at a certain point. If you look at their philosophical leanings and tendencies prior to taking significant public posts, they were very much into market dynamics. Both of them even had some influences which were Austrian related. Both of them liked gold. And then something changed pragmatically. But I think the coincidence is not just taking public office. It's also significant changes within the structure of finance and within the monetary system. And they dropped sort of their philosophical idealism and moved towards a more pragmatic approach to managing the system. And so we've talked to Paul Tucker here in the last week. Otmar Issing, who was 8 years at the European Central Bank, longest standing member of the European Central Bank. William White, who spent years at the Bank of International Settlements. And I think what you see from our direct conversations is that these are people making educated guesses. And there's art as well as some science, but probably, as William White would say, more art than science. And they do make lots of mistakes. So I guess a part of my response ties into the next part of the question from Charles.
Yeah, which is, why do we keep giving them the benefit of the doubt, assuming their decisions are made in ignorance? And actually, they're not made in ignorance, but they do have a certain mandate.
Yeah. And he also says that, you know, banking positions with a debt, one of the most powerful positions in the world, getting to those positions requires outstanding skills and knowledge coupled with political capital to climb up the ladder. And it's indispensable to get to the top. These people are not stupid.
Right.
I totally agree. I agree. They're not stupid. And I don't think they're intentionally malevolent. This comes back to this notion of a textbook bias and how they're operating on the basis of what they believe to be the best tools for the most pragmatic results. And I think some of those results actually tie to a view of the good life or a perfect world, which maybe is something that's up for debate. You know, it's not necessarily the case that we have to have unending growth. That's one of the reasons why we talked to Tomáš Sedláček, who came alongside Václav Havel in the period of time where the Czech Republic was coming out of communism. And as a 23-year-old prodigy, he's giving economic advice for this country who was moving from communism to capitalism. And in his book, The Economics of Good and Evil, he highlights that no, growth isn't necessarily the end all and be all. And yet, that's where I think when we think of decisions that are being made, a game plan that's being put together, mistakes, it's not necessarily the work that's being done that should be critiqued as much as the assumptions that it's based on and the direction that it's headed towards, which opens up the possibility of pursuing growth at any cost. So if the ends justify the means, so to say, then we'll do anything we can to keep the economy going and rolling and growing infinitely, including stacking on more debt than ultimately is healthy and sustainable.
Well, and wasn't that Paul Tucker's point? What we need is we need actually some limitations to these institutions. It may not be the intentions that we can change, but it's the limitations. Charles goes on, Richard Werner's views on the need to fight concentration of power in the hands of a few with the banking world is behind this question. And you brought up Sedláček. Good for you, Charles, because you've obviously read Sedláček's book. Here's in the question, it says, Sedláček's Economics of Good and Evil speaks of this too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, cycles bring into play this balancing between how much control and power central banks have. And I think one of the reasons we brought Paul Tucker into the, Sir Paul Tucker into the conversation is because there are, even among central bankers, recognitions that these limits need to be in place or they may lose their franchise. So, you know, yes, power has been concentrated, but yes, I think they're also aware that if you don't hand some of it back, it will be taken back because ultimately there is a social and political response to it.
Well, and we've talked about controlling information, and the last part of Charles's question says controlling information of transactions, financial transactions, as opposed to previous eras of control of land and resources. That has something to do with this too. That overlaps that big data question from our other listener.
Yeah, because I think central planners or central bankers, what they do assume is the closer they can get to the data and its flows, the more, and almost develop something predictive on the basis of those inferences, on the basis of those correlations, is that they can maybe even define what the next choices will be. So momentum matters. The flow of those financial transactions matter. And as they sort of move backwards, read them and their significance, and then try to project forward how to sort of channel the flows. This is where big data and central planning and central banking, it's all coming together.
Well, and I'm going to ask my own question. Hasn't momentum investing, it always works for about 90% of the time. And then when it goes terribly wrong, it goes terribly wrong because the momentum changes and the momentum no longer is the direction of the market. I mean, it changes the momentum to the other side.
It works until it doesn't. And it was one of my most painful lessons as a young investor, not as a professional, but as someone who had handed the reins to someone else to do this, the strategy Insight Capital, I'll never forget, a total momentum player. And, you know, it worked well through the 90s. And all you could look at was gain upon gain upon gain upon gain upon gain.
Like now.
But the amazing thing is, at that point of reversal, and this was actually one of the trigger points for me to go to work for Morgan Stanley, because I said, this is never going to happen to me again. I want to understand what happened here in my education process, very hands-on, on-the-job training, so to say, began 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003. Cut my teeth in the financial markets in the context of a bear market, but it was the front edge of that bear market that got my attention in a major way. Because it's one thing to make money 20, 30%, a quarter, or you know, gosh, what a modest return, 30% in a year.
What if this continued for my life? Yeah.
But it's an amazing experience to watch an 80% decline occur in 60 to 90 days. Hmm. And not to have an explanation, but when momentum stops, as you say, it works until it doesn't. And when it doesn't work anymore, it's dead. It's dead. And so that loss with Insight Capital was a very significant contribution to me trying to figure out the way things work.
This next question is from Australia, from Matt. And this is a question we get here in the United States as well. He says, hi, has there ever been a time when governments have confiscated 401ks, or as we call them in Australia, super funds?
You know, they're too new a product to have a precedent there. So, I mean, what are 401ks, 403bs, those types of retirement plans? They replaced pensions and they moved what was a long-term liability for a company to a risk asset for an individual. And that individual now has to manage that asset into the future. It's basically like an income liability, future income liability shifted to the worker. In essence, it's too new. It's too new for a precedent. But what is not new is having allocations within financial structures, which are bullied, you know, essentially where, and it's ironic that we have, you know, conversations in the schoolroom today or the classroom today about bullying, or even in the workplace about bullying, and maybe even the Oval Office about bullying. But there's no problem when it comes to government making choices that limit options for us. Hmm. There's precedent for that. And I think we'll see that again where, you know, you can choose A, B, C, and D. These are your choices. That's all you need. Well, that's a form of bullying and it has happened. And the only thing that comes to mind is perhaps back in the 80s.
Yeah, when Jesse Jackson was campaigning in 88, he said, you know, there's an awful lot of IRAs out there we might be able to help Social Security with.
And well, exactly. So so we don't have a precedent.
Right.
There's never been a confiscation. I think people need to be aware of having limited options. And so doing what you can on your own, I think makes a ton of sense. You're looking at IRAs and 401ks. Roth IRAs and whatnot, and taking advantage of that as much as you can.
Yeah, don't run away from them because the tax advantage is too good. You can just be careful and watch them in case something changes, right?
In fact, you know what I would do? This is a very practical point. It's not a part of the question, but I think I should segue to this, and we'll come back to the actual questions here in a minute. But when you look at your IRAs, I would look at 2020 as an opportunity to begin converting or do as much converting as possible from traditional to Roth IRAs. It's obviously up for grabs in terms of who wins in 2020. We don't know how this whole DC trial and things relating to Trump will pan out.
But 2024 is still coming, right?
Well, yeah. I guess my point is, you know, you have 2020 in terms of the tax code that is going to be on friendly terms for you. So from an income standpoint, if you can maximize conversion from a traditional to a Roth, settle up with Uncle Sam without bumping into higher and higher tax brackets. So you want to do this judiciously, carefully, with the help and advice, the guidance of a CPA, but maximize the conversion to a Roth so that you're now for life sitting on a pool of tax-free investments. Whatever capital gains you have theretofore would be tax-free.
Well, and we would encourage you to give us a call. We can help you with that at 800-525-9556. We can help with that.
And yeah, you're right. 2024 is looming out there. Should Trump win, you then have 4 years to get it all converted, because at the end of 4 years, I can guarantee you the political pendulum is swinging. So it's either swinging hard in 2020 or it's swinging hard in 2024. Many people focus on what they make in terms of their investment returns. I would like for you to say, it's not only what you make, but it's what you keep at the end of the day. So tax efficiency is very important. One of the ways that you can maximize tax efficiency in your total planning initiatives is to look at this kind of conversion from traditional IRA dollars into Roth IRA dollars.
Talking about the pendulum swinging at some point, this next question is from Mike. And he says, what exactly, as far as you can tell, would a global financial reset look like? What impact would a 100% billionaire tax have on the economy, good or bad, as proposed by cancelbillionaires.com? The government confiscated gold in 1933 on the basis of national security, and they could easily again. What signs should we look for of impending confiscation?
I think a couple of things. One, I want to clarify, you might think it was on the basis of national security that they confiscated gold, and you might infer that from the name of the act, the Trading with the Enemy Act. You know, so that was there, but what were they actually accomplishing? They were accomplishing wrapping their arms around the money supply. They were basically finally moving the keys of the kingdom from the Senate to the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System had been around for 20 years, 1913, the founding of the Federal Reserve, passage of the Federal Reserve Act, but there was still limits in terms of the ability to create enough liquidity in a market downturn. And so you've got the Fed pounding the table between 29, 30, 31, 32, that, you know, although they've been given the mandate, they haven't been given the machinery. And so by getting gold out of the domestic trade, you know, it stayed, we created a two-tier system. One where we were still settling our obligations in gold with foreign creditors, but domestically you couldn't own it. And the purpose really was not national security. Again, the title of it, Trading with the Enemy Act, might have implied that, but the real objective was, now we can inflate. Now we can inflate. Now we can devalue our currency. And you're in the context of a major global competitive currency devaluation, and tied to gold, we all of a sudden were the strongest currency, where, you know, the pound sterling had already been devalued. So we now are like standing out like a sore thumb. The dollar was priced too high. We devalued by 65%. That was the purpose.
Okay, so that's the gold confiscation, but what do you think about a billionaire tax? I know some people are talking about it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is there are unintended consequences. You say, well, this policy solves this problem, and it's by matching up dollars and cents. I don't have enough, you have too much, but we can make the math work. What you end up doing, if that is what you choose to do from a policy perspective, is shift the incentive structures within the market economy. And now all of a sudden, reward for risk is something that's really a challenged concept. At what point do those rules, or the arbitrary nature of it being $1 billion today, when does that get rolled back? And by the way, billionaires are a new thing for us. You know, we could have said the same thing and gone after the 10th of the 10th of the 10th of the 1%. And that was the millionaire class, right? But so as time goes on, as we continue to devalue our currency, you know, we've gone from let's go after the rich, 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 the millionaires, to now let's go after the rich, rich, rich billionaires. At some point, it's going to be let's go after the rich, 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 the trillionaires, because it's still what we have is a structural problem within our system, which is we can create an infinite amount of currency and credit because of the fiat nature of our money. And so that's really one of the side issues is we've got an arbitrary measure of monetary value and of wealth with our currency system as it is. And I would be very cautious to go after the billionaires, even if you can. And I don't go here, but even if you did want to make the case that there's something unjust about them having so much more, again, that's not my shtick. But if you wanted to make that case, be aware of the fact that you are pulling the rug out from underneath of one of the most powerful things that we have in the United States of America. And we have it here more than any place in the world. And that is, you can take risk and there is reward for it. If you try and fail, you get to try and try and try again. That's not the case everywhere else too, because not only do we have a market system that encourages risk taking and the potential of reward, but in the case that you fail, you don't get a black mark where you do in Europe. I know many people who've failed in their business ventures in Europe in their 30s and 40s or even earlier in their 20s, and you're not allowed to open up banking relationships. You're not allowed to have a certificate of being in business on a second or third basis. It's like the scarlet letter. You know, we don't think of the scarlet letter anymore because it relates to morality, and we have much looser morality today than we've ever had, or maybe that we've had in 100 years or whatever. But my point is, no one's wearing a scarlet letter because of some misdeed of the past. And yet, there are places in the world where, from a business standpoint, you wear a black letter, the bankruptcy letter, and you're never allowed. You're shamed forever. We have this dynamic market in the United States, and I think it's more dynamic than any other place in the world. And to be introducing something like a billionaire tax, what you're doing is you're beginning to restructure what makes this place different and so vibrant.
Our next question is from Glenn from Central Virginia. Dave, this is a question that pertains to one of our favorite subjects, and that is, how do we value gold relative to other things like the Dow? So reading the question from Glenn, over the years, you've said that once we reach a Dow gold ratio of between 5-to-1 and 1-to-1, that we should begin liquidating our gold and silver positions and move into other asset classes. I know in the late 1970s or the early 80s, that would have been a great move. But what do you think this time? Do you think this time is different? The problems we face today are so much more serious than 40 years ago. I think we could go beyond 1-to-1 Dow gold ratio with the current bubble and when it bursts. With this in mind, do you think it could make sense to hold on to a significant portion of your precious metals holdings until we get to a 1-to-1 Dow gold ratio or beyond? What are your thoughts?
I want to start with something maybe off the beaten track. And it's, when you're organizing your assets, you're organizing them according to certain mandates. That's my view, where you have a certain percentage allocated to liquid assets. This is what we call our perspective triangle. I love the simplicity of it because you can communicate it to kids, grandkids, or anyone, and it's just clear how you save, why you save, and what you do with your money. So the how, what, and why fits neatly into the perspective triangle. So this is different than your typical pie chart where you're saying just have a little bit of everything, the melange approach to investing. And certainly there's validity there to the degree that you're just talking about the merits of diversification. But what I like about the perspective triangle is you're lining out mandates. Cash is liquidity. That's the liquidity mandate. And it serves its own purpose. I'm not going to go into this. There's plenty of things we've written about this and talked about this, but I just want to give an overview because, you know, liquidity is one thing. Left side of the triangle, opposite of liquidity, is growth and income, stocks, bonds, what have you. I'm more concerned about the mandate than I am the particulars, at least for kind of a high level overview of what these parts are doing for you. The base of the triangle is what we call insurance, and that's where gold and silver sit. And the insurance mandate is there regardless of a market environment. You always have a little bit of it. And here's where it fits into, Glenn, your question, because you're asking about the Dow Gold ratio. Let's say you had a certain percentage in stocks and bonds, a certain percentage in cash, a certain percentage in gold and silver. Okay, so let's just take that for the sake of argument as a very basic asset allocation. Not a lot of color, not a lot of detail, but let's just speak in general terms. Now you get to a Dow Gold 5-to-1 or 1-to-1 ratio, and what happens is that insurance component there at the base of the triangle, you might have had an equilateral triangle to start, but now you've got a very much isosceles triangle. The growth of gold as you get to a 1-to-1 ratio expands out that base so large and so wide, it requires that you take action. It
reallocation.
You reallocate. Yeah. So I think one of the things implicit, Glenn, to your question is when we get to a 1-to-1 and we're out of gold, what if it goes lower and shouldn't we have kept it longer? And my point is you're creating a problem that I don't have because I'm not eliminating my gold position. I'm reducing my gold position. So when I talk about a 5-to-1 or a 3-to-1 or a 1-to-1 ratio, that is a gradual reduction. You're easing out of a position. This is what we love on the wealth management side to call an incremental approach to either buying or selling. And that incremental approach is you're selling a portion at 5-to-1, a portion at 3-to-1, a portion at 1-to-1. That does not mean that you are out of the asset class.
Because you're just rebalancing the triangle.
Why would you want to eliminate the insurance that is implicit to your total wealth picture? Now, you may reduce it because it became disproportionately large, right? So you're scaling back versus scaling out. Does that make sense?
Rich asks the question about the repo market. We've been talking a lot about this liquidity infusion, Dave, so here's how it goes. He says, I admire your thoughtful and in-depth discussions every week. Yours is a knowledge built on genuine exploration of ideas and attempts to unpack questions to reveal all they encompass. Your appreciation of history is also impressive. My concerns are that recent repo life support activity by the central bank is a potential indication that something is deeply wrong with the money market arena. Oh, you think? Overnight liquidity appears to be at a premium right now, evidenced by the demand for these loans. Is this the markets showing they're concerned about counterparty risk? And is this the canary in the coal mine?
Well, clearly it shows stress and strain in the market. That the Fed has, the tail end of the year, has had to come up with an extra $500 billion in overnight liquidity. And this, think about that. We lose track of what these numbers mean, but $500 billion just to make sure that money markets and banks function smoothly through the end of the year. That is astounding. So yes, you're right to a degree. It is a canary. Last week in one of our wealth management meetings, Doug Noland commented that, you know, right now you've got risk on in the marketplace. Risk on meaning people are more than willing to push prices of stocks up. As we talked about earlier, credit default swaps on Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, in the spreads between high yield and treasuries, and a number of other measures of stress or strain in the market, are suggesting that there is no stress or strain in the market now. So you've got kind of a mixed message, because on the one hand, the repo markets are telling you something's not functioning in a healthy way. True enough. And the Fed is willing to acknowledge that and make sure that that market is backstopped so that there's no surprises. But there will not be an implosion in the repo market unless you move from risk on to risk off. And this is one of Doug's key points. The environment is different. Right now, it's risk on. So you do have the potential for greater repo issues, but you're not going to see them emerge as long as there is a low level of concern in the marketplace. You see the shift towards risk off, where people aren't as enthusiastic owning stocks. There is more concern about default bets within the marketplace, individual companies, sectors, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, the repo jitters, it becomes very serious. It becomes very serious. I think the last thing I'll say on counterparty risk and the concern about counterparty risk was highlighted in a Bank of International Settlements paper just a few weeks ago, where they go on and on about why the Fed was doing what they were doing. And in this Bank of International Settlements paper, again, BIS is out of Basel, Switzerland, and they're the central bank to the central banker. One of the things that they noted, it was last paragraph or maybe second to last paragraph in a lengthy paper, was to say, but we have other people showing up in the repo markets, and the fact that the hedge funds are getting some of their liquidity here is reason for concern. That right there, Rich, is where I would underscore, highlight, exclamation point, because it's no longer just banks and money markets who are getting liquidity. It is a different kind of counterparty. It is a different kind of entity that's taking risk. And these are folks who have no problem taking 10, 15, 20 times leverage, getting the free money, investing at high stakes. And yeah, there can be implications if something goes wrong in the bets that they're making. And the BIS is aware of it. The Fed is aware of it. These are pending issues. They're structural problems which have not been fixed. And again, it's good today. It gets really messy tomorrow if you have the same Fed commitments and the BIS concerns in the context of risk off versus risk on.
So speaking of canaries in coal mines, follow the money. If there's liquidity problems, usually that's a canary. Right. Okay. Next question. You mentioned that the questions are getting somewhat more complicated year after year. So I decided to ask a rhetorical one. In other words, without the need for an explicit answer. Dave, you may have some comments on this anyway. So let me read it through. You know that by law, the executive branch can initiate a military intervention against a foreign country without permission from Congress for up to 90 days. You may know that 80 years ago, the state of the military hardware back then, half of Poland has been overrun by the army of the Third Reich and the rest of its neighbors. I mean, we do know that, and we've talked extensively about that with clients in the past. In other words, it's quite a serious matter that no majority from Congress is needed for a military adventure abroad. If I may borrow the words from a former congressman, now, even though they don't comment on the matter in the media or in speeches, can you imagine how that power of the Oval Office is perceived in some other countries by their leaders? I doubt that they would call it a democratic process. So, granted, it's a rhetorical question, but Dave, there are times when we go to war and Congress is not involved.
Well, and I think that points to one of the many ironies that we have about our system and the way it functions practically in the world. While we're sponsors of democracy hither and yon, and we try to bring that as representatives to the rest of the world, the irony is we don't have democratic processes in many instances, and this is one of them. So the military adventure or military adventurism, it's there. War is always an option. And I think one of the things we have to consider in the years ahead is the way that war is an option for political reasons as a distraction. I was fascinated this last week or 2 weeks, you know, with the most recent passage of the military defense spending bill. We now have another branch of the military, the space warfare. So why is that important? For me, ultimately, you're talking about new fiscal pressure. And I agree that there's an inference here in the question or comment or rhetorical statement or whatever, that other countries and leaders around the world may not like what we're doing. I think that's fair. And yeah, we are kind of in other people's business. I think that's fair to say. The other thing that we should keep in mind when it comes to our military adventures is that sometimes they serve a purpose, and not necessarily a good purpose. But again, if you look at this from the standpoint of we're pawns on a larger chessboard, and there's players who are calling shots that implicate us, both from a fiscal standpoint and even longer-term military commitments. You look at Lusitania. The sinking of the Lusitania was very critical for the move into a world war. Pearl Harbor was very critical to our moving into a world war. Tonkin Bay. These are things that happen, and we have military responses, and then they have the fiscal and monetary implications.
Then we had the strange 9/11, which had nothing to do with Iraq, but it did help give the momentum into Iraq.
A precipitated involvement in Iraq, and you're right. And there was energy needed to pass the Patriot Act, and it wouldn't have passed otherwise. So you've got all of these events that occur and a military response, and no, there's not a democratic process involved per se.
Yeah, I think what we've seen in the past is even if a president sends troops to war without Congress's approval, if we need to be in a place according to the powers that be, there will be an incident that causes the public opinion to be motivated to go in.
That's exactly right. Which, again, if you're thinking back to how many of these things, you know, sort of relate to each other, perception management, control of public opinion, getting people on the right side of history, so to say. If you can move the needle on getting people on the right side of history, which is basically swaying public opinion on any particular issue, then you can do anything you want. Politicians know that.
Our next question comes from a man who calls himself the Midnight Gardener. He said he recently read a blog post that said, hyperinflation will fix that. Without trying to break down the content of that post, do you think hyperinflation will help fix at least part of what ails the USA at this time? If hyperinflation does occur, I suspect those who hold gold will be much happier after such an event than stock market dwellers. By the way, I very much enjoy the weekly podcast. What do you think, Dave? Hyperinflation, are we on the cusp of it, or is it something that they've learned to manage?
My opinion is that hyperinflation is one of the most devastating things that a country or an economy can experience. So whatever it fixes in terms of having too much debt, it harms in a thousand other ways. And I think to get a real human picture of the consequence of hyperinflation, reading the book When Money Dies is absolutely critical, because it's not about the math involved. It's about the human tragedy and the stories involved in the context
Adam Ferguson.
That's right. Again, on the surface, it does solve a debt problem. It just makes it all go away. But I think there's greater social and economic things that occur through that that would be absolutely devastating. And yet, we, to some degree, we're sort of tempting fates with it, with the current monetary machinery in play. In terms of high rates of inflation, or let's just say an orchestrated devaluation of the currency and that being good for gold, I'm not optimistic about that. I'm pessimistic about that. And a part of that comes from a book that I read. I was going to meet Larry Kotlikoff, teaches at Boston University and in the economics department, was going to his house in Boston. And he texted me and said, listen, I'm going to be about 20 minutes late. Can you just circle for a minute? And so I did. I went around his neighborhood circling, found a used bookstore.
Oh, you found a bookstore, Dave.
I did. And I found a book.
It just happened to run into a used bookstore.
Yeah.
That's your passion.
Well, and this was a book written in the 1960s. And it was a collection of essays, including an essay from John Exeter. My dad knew him. And, you know, he's part of the inner workings of our financial world in the 1960s. And 70s. And, you know, the Exeter liquidity triangle was something that my dad always liked to use in his presentations back in the 70s. But there was also an essay in this book by another central banker. And the debate was, should we devalue the currency like we did in the 1930s? If we do, we have to penalize the speculators. And specifically, they were saying people who owned gold, we've got to raise the bar such that they can't profit from the devaluation. And so there's this policy reality that if you see an orchestrated devaluation of the currency on a major scale, not like 10%, 15%, but if it's 50% or more, then I think all of a sudden you also have a policy attack against anything that represents, you know, a port in the storm, so to say. Something that provides you an out or protection from that devaluation, you can guarantee that government will move against that. Otherwise, they're dealing with a mass stampede. The policies for them of devaluation only work if they have a captured audience. If they give you options of how to opt out, then all of a sudden the policy is less effective. And so that was the debate going on in this book. And I you know, I'm just paging through it. I'm like, all right, I got to buy this.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. So
well,
I went upstairs.
Isn't that the reason why people who had collectibles at that time, whatever it was, whether it was coins or other things made of gold, actually benefited from the devaluation in the 30s. It was the bullion owner that didn't benefit. They just went ahead and took it.
Right, right. So I guess what is fair in the context of the hyperinflationary comments and the contrast between gold and stocks is that stocks tend to outperform on the front end of a major inflation or hyperinflation, and gold plays significant catch up. So if you sort of broke it into sort of phase deterioration or put it on sort of a hyperbolic curve, you know, there's a long period of time where stocks are a superior inflation hedge to gold. And then somewhere as you reach the steepness of the curve, stocks become worthless. You go from maintaining a good bit of your value to maintaining some of your value to maintaining no value at all.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, again, on the steepness of that parabolic curve, gold maintains all of your value while your stocks are worthless.
And again, that's the Germany model. I mean, we saw that. Adam Ferguson talked about that, and several other authors talked about that.
Yeah. So I you know, not that our you know, a tactical short is oriented towards these kinds of extreme outcomes, sort of hyperinflation or whatnot. But I think it's worth recognizing that there are phase shifts and there are phases of deterioration, whether it's within the financial markets or within the monetary system or within the banking system. And you've got to play each of those phases in a different way. It's not enough to say, you know, I own stocks, I'll be fine. Or I own gold and I'll be fine. If you're just looking from beginning to end, yes, own gold, you'll be fine. But there are this interim period where you're like, wow, gosh, maybe I should own stocks. They're doing so much better. Yeah, that's right. They do. In that phase one of a superinflation or hyperinflation, stocks do better than gold just before you get wiped out. Now, are you smart enough to pull the trigger and get out? Because you're talking about massive growth and figuring out, it's almost like, where do you jump off the roller coaster? Where do you jump off? How do you jump off? If you believe that you can, you probably don't understand the structure of that ride.
Well, that'll wrap it up for our Christmas program. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.